KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Sunnyvale, California.
Oakland, California.
Oakland, California.
North Oakland.
North Oakland.
North Berkeley.
South Berkeley.
Adams Point.
Yosemite.
Coming up, we'll visit Butte County to learn how cooks in a local food truck are contributing to the campfire relief efforts.
It was overwhelming when everything was going on because with that many people on such a large scale, going through such a loss, I don't know where to begin. How do I help everybody?
Then we'll see how massive chemical companies impacted farming in India, leading to large-scale migration to California.
First, we had a lot of cotton, she says. We sprayed it with so many pesticides, it just dried up.
What goes wrong and how to fix it, coming up on Cross Currents. It's been almost a month since the campfire burned through the entire town of Paradise in Butte County. The fire destroyed 153,000 acres, including 19,000 buildings and homes. Since then, nearby businesses like food trucks, printing companies, and breweries have banded together, finding creative ways to contribute on a small scale using whatever resources they can. But many of these businesses are grappling with big questions. How do you help your distressed community when the needs are overwhelming? And how do you come to terms with the reality that sometimes what you have to offer isn't exactly enough? Reporter Asala Sanipour went to Chico to learn more.
Just off an industrial street in Chico, tucked away from the city's downtown, is Secret Trail Brewing Company. I'm here on the Saturday after Thanksgiving. They've had a couple days of rain, so the sky is clear and sunny as people sip their beers outside. You'd never know that about a dozen miles away, the entire town of Paradise burned to the ground. But the brewery's co-owner, Jesse Fisher, says since the campfire tore through Butte County, it's been a sort of safe haven for the people of Paradise.
First off, we just opened our doors.
While other local businesses closed, in the weeks following the fire, Jesse says the brewery's been a place for first responders and evacuees to unwind. He's even seen people complete insurance paperwork over a beer. Though the atmosphere today seems carefree and fun, he says that the city of Chico is still in disbelief about what happened to Paradise.
As Chicoans, I mean, you know, we're all intermixed with people, family that lives up there, friends that lost their homes. It's never going to sink into everybody until you realize there's not a town up on the hill anymore.
Jesse tells me the brewery parking lot served as a home base for local food trucks wanting to help people affected by the fire. He says some delivered hundreds of meals to nearby camps.
Okay, beautiful. I'll bring that out to you in a few.
Drunken Dumpling is a small food truck that parks outside the brewery a few days a week. It's run by just two people, so they couldn't make the hundreds of meals they'd need to deliver directly to the camps. But co-owner Lizzie Young says as soon as she knew about the scale of the fires, she committed to offering free meals at the breweries where they park to anyone impacted.
No matter what, this is what we're gonna do, because when these people that we know, or if we, even if we don't know, we find out they have lost their homes and they've been displaced, there's no way we're not gonna give them a free plate of food, or two, or three.
Lizzie says on one day, about a week after the fire, Drunken Dumpling gave away 100 plates of food from their spot here in the brewery parking lot. She says in those days immediately after the fire, there were long lines for dumplings. Most of the people who visited their truck were evacuees, waiting to find out if their houses were standing or not.
Nobody had been able to go home, and it was like everybody had been displaced.
That could have very easily been Lizzie. She lived in Paradise for a decade and still owns property there that burned. But when the fire started, she was at her home 30 miles away.
Yeah, it was a surreal experience. Honestly, I'll never forget it. I was going for a jog. There was this huge, it almost looked like fog rolling into the valley, but it was dark smoke, but there was also this huge mushroom cloud, and I was just like, remember thinking, I'm like, that is not good. That is a very big fire.
She and her family were eventually evacuated too. In the days that followed, Lizzie's priority was calling her friends from Paradise to make sure they were safe. Slowly, she gathered information about the town that meant so much to her.
It was sad. It was really depressing, realizing that a whole town had just been lost. A bunch of my friends had just lost their homes. A lot of places that were dear to me, you know, where I created a lot of wonderful memories, being just gone, wiped away. It's a weird thing to wrap your head around. In a way, you almost grieve for a whole entire town.
All of her most significant adult memories are from her decade living in Paradise.
In Paradise, I met the love of my life and formed many friendships. We had our daughter Isabella in Paradise, conceived our business, Drunken Dumpling, in Paradise.
Their friends even taste tested their recipes in Paradise. That's why it matters so much to Lizzie to help her former neighbors, somehow.
It was overwhelming when everything was going on, because with that many people on such a large scale going through such a loss, you experience, you're just like, I don't know where to begin. How do I help everybody?
They can't help everybody, but they've been doing their best with what they have. Dumplings.
I have an Asian dip that's got to go out.
Lizzie's partner, John Dean, has worked in the restaurant business a long time.
Let's see. Sarah, AD, to go. You rock, yo.
He's charismatic, learns everyone's name. It's clear his customers are friends, regulars he's come to know. In the weeks after the fire, John learned that some of his regulars lost their homes. He knows Drunken Dumpling doesn't have the capacity to serve meals to the masses.
We can't do thousands of meals, so if we can do 100 meals, then we do 100 meals. We can do 20 meals, and we do 20 meals. You know, we do 10 meals, we do 10 meals.
But since Thanksgiving, the rain helped contain the fires and wash away the smoke. Some people even started returning to their homes.
So I have no idea what to expect today. No idea what to expect today.
John planned for the unexpected by preparing plenty of food just in case. He even skipped Thanksgiving dinner to get a head start on cooking. So today he bustles around the tiny cart, finishing order after order, ready for when a fire survivor shows up. He's got plenty of customers today, but none of them are from Paradise.
Like today, I'm not seeing anyone. This is really weird.
Why? Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I don't know. I really don't.
An hour goes by, two, three, but no one here is a fire evacuee. Still, John tries to spread the word.
Just so you know, and so that every, just so you know, and that if you know anybody, anybody that's got had an issue with this fire, it's in this place, you get your food for free. You know that.
But by the end of today, none of Drunken Dumpling's customers are fire survivors. John and Lizzie suspect people in the most extreme need aren't hanging out at breweries right now, but they still want to contribute with free dumplings. They're prepared to do this for as long as it takes.
I think it's just been the last couple days where I've come to terms with the destruction that happened in Paradise, and just coping with that myself. But this is a long-term thing, and maybe that's serving food to people, or maybe that's helping out in a different way, because those needs will change.
Those needs are already changing. Right after the fire, the focus was on basic needs like a familiar meal and a free drink. But maybe now it's about imagining the future, embracing for the enormous challenges that'll present themselves along the way. In Butte County, I'm Asala Sanipour for Cross Currents.
You can find that story and other coverage of the Camp Fire at KELW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. We're going to go overseas now for our next story, the final episode of a series that won the Investigative Reporting Award from the San Francisco Press Club last month. Sukhbir Singh Badal, the former deputy chief minister of Punjab, wrote a Facebook post back in 2015 that went viral. "I want Punjab to be like California," he wrote. "I know it can't be done in one day, 1 year, or even 10 years, but I am sowing seeds." His father, the former chief minister, was asked about this at a press conference.
Punjab nu California banan di gal kiti.
Banai ja rahe kare.
Nahi tusi kya si?
Dekho, tusi gal suno.
The reporter says there's been talk of making Punjab into California. The chief minister replies, "We are making it California." In response to this, Punjabis on social media started posting pictures and videos of poor infrastructure in Punjab. Flooded streets, unrepaired roads, villages with no access to clean water, writing hashtag Punjab California underneath. But trolling aside, this idea of California as a model for Punjab has deeper roots. KLW's Kaval Roop Kaur Singh picks up the story from here.
The weekly farmers market in Milpitas, California is bustling. Dozens of small farmers are here selling their fruits and vegetables to passersby. Ku Yang is one of them.
$1.70 for this? This is yours, right?
He farms with his family on 6 acres in Fresno. Ku's farm is small, as are most in California. But it's the large-scale industrial farmers who grow most of the state's food. In fact, California was a pioneer of industrial agriculture. Carl Sauer, a geographer at UC Berkeley in the 1960s, pointed out that the Green Revolution was attempting to export the Californian model of agriculture to places like Punjab in India. I've been reporting on farming in the two states, so I ask Ku if he knows of any Punjabi farmers in Fresno.
There are, but the funny thing is they're more the professional ones, the really big ones that do like the orchards and the almonds and the peaches where they do in, you know, industrial ag. I've seen a couple Indians, Punjabis, there doing that. Small little farmers market, not as much.
California produces over a third of the vegetables and two-thirds of the fruits and nuts consumed in the U.S. If California is the produce basket of the U.S., then Punjab is the grain basket of India. The main crops are wheat and rice, but most of the Punjabi farmers there are nothing like the Punjabi farmers in California. That's what I find out firsthand. I'm in a grain market in Chandigarh, the capital of Punjab. Workers are sweeping wheat into a mound and feeding it through a processor. A farmer from a neighboring city, Gurjant Singh, watches silently. He's just sold 45,000 pounds of grain. But he says his business isn't going so well. I haven't been able to save anything, he says. I'm just barely able to cover my expenses. Using fertilizers and pesticides has become really expensive for farmers in Punjab, especially when it turns out they don't work. 2 years ago, farmers in the cotton-growing belt were growing BT cotton. BT cotton is a pest-resistant, genetically modified seed produced by Monsanto, the U.S.-based multinational corporation. In 2015, after whiteflies devastated Punjab's BT cotton crop, a new pesticide called Oberon was marketed to farmers by another multinational corporation, Bayer. But farmers say the pesticide failed. Sukhjeet Kaur remembers. "First, we had a lot of cotton," she says. "We sprayed it with so many pesticides, and when it was supposed to be ripe for picking, it just dried up." I'm surrounded by a group of elderly farmers in Begelere, a village in the Bathinda district of Punjab, at the center of Punjab's cotton-growing belt. Bathinda is in one of the regions with the highest cancer rates in the state. There's a train that departs each evening from Batinda called the Cancer Train. It's filled every day with patients seeking cancer treatment in a hospital 200 miles away. I ask the villagers if there's a cancer problem in their village. A farmer named Bajitthar Singh answers. At least 10 people in our village have it, he says. Then everyone begins to talk at once. One man, Bola Singh, speaks up above the rest. The people here are so poor, he says, we can't even afford to get tested. So we don't even know if we have cancer or not. The villagers say they think pesticides are the reason for all the cancer in the region. I ask if they can show me one of the pesticides that they use. They bring me a blue and yellow spray can with a picture of the sun shining over a bountiful farm. It's a fungicide called Tilox, manufactured by Axis Crop Science, an Indian pesticide company. On the back, it says, "Danger, keep away from people." It lists the active ingredient as a chemical called propiconazole. I find out later that propiconazole is listed by the US EPA as a possible human carcinogen, meaning it could cause cancer. Where can people go? How can they get tested for cancer? Asks Bola. Even if they go, no one listens. Only the wealthy get treated, not the poor. A few days later, I visit a pesticide factory in Derabasi, a city in southern Punjab. The factory is owned by Pioneer Pesticides, an Indian pesticide company. Yashbir Singh Mann, the coordination manager, tells me to put a hospital mask over my nose and mouth before we go inside. He doesn't put one on, though. He says he's used to the environment. The factory floor is large and open. Two giant chemical tanks stand in one corner. Workers in an assembly line bottle and package pesticides. Some of them aren't wearing gloves or shoes. I can smell the chemicals through my mask. After about 20 minutes, we go back outside. I'm relieved. Yashbir flips through the manual that details the provisions of the Insecticide Act, outlining the Indian government's regulations on pesticides.
There are very strict guidelines to use these products.
He says pesticide companies are required to file reports detailing how much product they've sold in order to comply with regulations. I ask him, is it possible for a company to lie in the records and say they sold less than they actually did so they aren't penalized for their extra profit? He says, it is possible. There are some differences between the US and India in the way pesticide use is regulated. In the US, farmers are required to report to the government how much pesticide they use. But in India, there's no such requirement. This means farmers could easily use more than the recommended amount without consequences. The farmer has no responsibility to tell the government how much of our product he has bought, he says. The farmer only goes to the government when he has a problem with a product. That's what happened when Bayer's pesticide Oberon didn't kill whiteflies on cotton plants. Corporations such as Bayer often subcontract with local Indian pesticide companies to have their products made. Multinational companies have been in India since the beginning of the pesticide industry, says Yashbir. There were no Indian companies in the field until later. They started up slowly and followed the multinationals. Yashbir says this trend began with Bayer around the 1980s. Bayer began as part of a German conglomerate called IG Farben. During World War II, IG Farben ran its own concentration camps and conducted experiments on Jewish prisoners. After the war, IG Farben was split into multiple companies, including Bayer. Bayer started to make pesticides and herbicides. Today, it is one of the largest distributors of agricultural chemicals in Punjab, with about 20 distribution centers across the state. Recently, Bayer announced that it would pay nearly $70 billion to buy Monsanto, another major player in Indian agriculture. Monsanto and Bayer would not speak with me for this story, but Monsanto's sustainability report says that it is working with Indian farmers to increase production sustainably. It also explains how Monsanto has engaged in philanthropy in India, preventing snake bites and child labor, helping build toilets, installing solar panels. But there's no mention of working with the farmers whose BT cotton crops were damaged, or with families of farmers who had committed suicide, a growing problem in Punjab. Chemical companies hold a lot of power in Punjab, but a small percentage of farmers are not buying in. Barminder Sharma is using a hoe to uproot the weeds on his 11-acre farm. Out of the many farms I've seen in Punjab, this is the first one where I've seen a hoe and not just a tractor tilling the land. Barminder's farm is organic. It's in a village called Sunam in the Sangrur district of Punjab. Sangrur was once lauded as a great success in agriculture following the Green Revolution, but today it has one of the highest farmer suicide rates in the state. At the end of the day, we lost more than we gained, he says. We may have produced more, but our quality went down. We lost our soil, our water, and our youth, who are committing suicide today. Before he became an organic farmer, Barminder was a lawyer for 12 years. Then he decided to return to his ancestral land and begin farming. Initially, it was difficult. He had to learn how to replenish the soil with natural nutrients. Barminder opens the lid of a giant black barrel. Inside is a mixture of cow manure and yogurt that is fermenting. He says this was how farmers would fertilize their fields in the old days. It's what he uses to keep the soil healthy, so he doesn't have to rely on the market for seeds, fertilizer, or pesticides. He's also in a cooperative where farmers loan each other equipment instead of buying their own. He uses WhatsApp groups to sell his crops. He reads an order that just came in.
1 kg kadu, 1 kg pindi, 1 kg karela.
That's squash, ladyfinger, and bitter gourd. Barminder also grows peppers, eggplants, peanuts, turmeric, rice, lentils, and wheat. We go into a mud hut that Barminder built on his farm. He meditates here every day. I ask him what he wants people to know about Punjab. Our Punjab is sick, he says. We need to take responsibility for that. What will we say to the next generations after we've destroyed the environment and consumed all the water? How will we face them? Barminder works closely with Kheti Virasat Mission, an NGO that encourages organic farming. According to them, 5,000 acres in Punjab are being farmed organically. That's less than 1% of Punjab's total agricultural land. In California, it's actually about the same. Less than 1% of California's farmland is organic.
And this is how you take it to the sheller. Mm. The sheller, they take this off.
Back in California, I'm cracking open nuts with Sandeep Singh, a Punjabi almond farmer on his farm in Tracy. He left Punjab in 1997.
They're really good.
Yeah, that tastes pretty good these days.
Sandeep is a conventional grower, not an organic one. I ask him why.
How come you didn't want to be organic?
Because when we bought this orchard, it was already 3 years old. I didn't plant the trees. It was already planted. So it was already too late to go organic. If you want to go organic, I guess you have to start it from the beginning.
I think Sandeep's answer is a metaphor for the dilemma that the farmers of the world face today. What do you do with the orchard you've inherited? You didn't plant it, you didn't develop it, yet you must find a way to make it bloom. For Cross Currents, I'm Kamalroop Gaur Singh.
That story was made possible in part by the International Center for Journalists. It's the third in a three-part series that recently won an award for excellence in investigative reporting by the San Francisco Press Club. You can listen to the full series at kalw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to the Cross Currents weekly newsletter. Catch up on all our stories once a week, every week. Today's team includes Janae Darden, Sarah Nora Coast, Angela Johnston, Maggie McKay, Kevin McLean, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega-Welch, True Quinn, and Eli Wertschafter. Our engineers are Tariq Foda, James Rollins, and Gabe Graben. Shirin Adil is our content manager. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Star Amurasu from Oakland, a self-described trans poptronic princess. She's singing her songs at the Elbow Room in San Francisco on Friday night. Show starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Let your light shine.